After the Russian invasion of Ukraine, humanitarian aid is needed for the victims of war. Medical supplies and care for the injured and refugees, as well as shelter and food. Please contact the United Ukrainian American Relief Committee, Inc. 1206 Cotman Avenue, Philadelphia, PA 19111. Memo line, Aid Victims of War in Ukraine. For information, please call 215-728-1630. UUARC is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. Gifts are tax deductible.
The opinions and statements expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WWDB, its staff, or management.
Power is on our floor, 15 to 20 million.
Jump
out
there.
I am your future.
Isn't it about time for a change?
We're our national leader.
AmericanWorkersRadio.com. You're listening to American Workers Radio, a national network promoting American-made products with your host, Michael Blihash.
Well, welcome once again to another edition of American Workers Radio here on 860 AM. As you know, we serve southeastern Pennsylvania, the state of New Jersey, and northern Delaware on the radio. However, our signal goes out through the internet. And if you're on Alexa, just Alexa 860 AM every Wednesday between 11 AM and 12 noon. I'm asking all of you to contact family and friends because we're going to have another exciting show this week and invite them to tune in. And of course, you can also email them a copy of today's broadcast around 2 o'clock when Henry gets it up there on the site. And let's get people together and keep them moving more and more in our direction. I want to say a special thank you to Mark Andel, who is the founder of the Made in America store. And as you know, we have a link right on the front page of our broadcast site, AmericanWorkersRadio.com. Click on that. It's right next to Mark's picture. And Mark also has a radio show that you can tune in and listen to as well. And right under that is the United States Debt Clock. And that is put out by the United States government. None of us. Also, is our very special Larkin Conley, a national small business advocate, Rich Logis, the principal of RJL Technology Integration. Our engineer is Henry Chaplinsky, and I am Michael Blihash. You know, I want to say, first of all, a thank you to last Wednesday's guest on the broadcast, Jason Kilmeyer, a well-known and respected political commentator and national security expert, and that is on the supply chain issues. Jason managed the Federal Supply Chain Risk Management Team. And of course, we're very pleased that he was on the broadcast. He's been on before, and he is now a candidate for political office, and we'll keep you posted as the May 15th primary comes about. And I'm looking forward to hearing from Jason and having him on the broadcast in the future. And I wish him the very best. Now, you can also hear rebroadcasts on the front page of AmericanWorkersRadio.com. And Jason had a lot to say last week, which I saw from reactions of the people. They felt were very interesting and very informative. Today, we have another special guest who is on our broadcast. He was here a few weeks ago, Professor Michael Bussler. And he is an experienced professor of finance at Stockton University in Galloway, New Jersey, where he teaches. And that is undergraduate and graduate courses in finance and economics, and with a demonstrated history of working in the higher education industry. The professor has done unbelievable work, and he's on several shows, and I'm very pleased. I know that he's been on Dawn's show last week, and I want to say that he does great work, and he has a lot of good things to say. I wish that more people in government and also in business would take a lot of his advice. Before I turn to our professor, part of our problem in America, from what people are telling me all the time, is too many people in elected office have not been out doing things for themselves, like shopping or going to the gas station and pumping gas to see what it's all about. It seems that the political people live in another world. other than the world that we're living in. Right now, we're living in inflation at its highest level in 40 years, and no matter how much you work, zero plus zero equals zero. The more they take from you, the poorer you become. And that's what inflation is doing to the American people. And yet people on the inside of government simply don't understand that. As Americans, all of us have the obligation to speak up when something is really wrong. If you see something happen in your community or on the road, somebody hits somebody and damages their car, you really have an obligation to at least let the person know if they ask you, did you see something? We, the American people, are doing what our national leaders and our business leaders should be doing. Many of the business leaders let America go down the drain by simply sending their jobs and business overseas and leaving the people here in the United States of America up in the air. And that's not really what it should be, and that's not what can allow us to exist as a quality economy. We see and discussed many times, nations of the world and their economies are going up, mainly because their people are employed. They have skills. They're doing things differently. Some of them are in communist countries, but still, because they have jobs in China and in other places, they are still having better times than many of our people in the poverty levels in America. And yet, everybody seems to turn their head when they look at the debt clock and see all of the people that are in poverty. Our actual unemployment rate from the United States government is listed on that debt clock, and it's over 12 million people. When they say, oh, the employment rate and all is up, it's up, but it's not up to where it should be. Based on those few things, I'd like to introduce our very special guest, Professor Michael Bussler. How are you doing, Professor?
Well, I'm doing very well, Michael. Thanks for having me. As you know, it's my pleasure to be here, and thank you for the kind words about me that you said in the beginning.
Well, I always hear good things from anywhere that you've been, so I'm very honored to have you here. And we're going to ask. I'm going to ask all of our panel members to ask you a few questions today.
Sure.
The first press question is going to be one that I asked Larkin Conley and Rich Loges and Mark Andel. If you were president of the United States, what would you do right now to change things for the better?
Well, mostly what I would do is reverse all of the policies that I put into place last year. Because while I believe President Biden had good intentions, the results of his policies have not been good. So what kind of policies am I talking about? Number one, you mentioned that we have a very severe inflation problem based on the last 12 months, that is February to February. The inflation rate is just about 8%. Now, unfortunately, it's going to get worse. The inflation number for March will be out, I think, April 12th. It's going to show that the annual inflation rate's probably up to the 8.5% range. And then the following month, it's likely to get even worse yet. And I would suspect by summer, inflation will probably be in the double digits, up to the 10% level. So why do we have that? And your question was, what would I do to fix that? So there's a few reasons why we have that, in my view. Now, the Biden administration and the Federal Reserve say that most of the inflation is due to disruptions in the supply chain. And as soon as the supply chain issues are resolved, inflation should go away. And lately they've said because of the Russian invasion in Ukraine and the disruption in some supply of products like oil and soon to be food, we'll get inflation from that. Now, I don't completely agree with that. Number one, on the supply chain, the economy today is producing at a rate that's about 2% higher than before the pandemic. So in total, There's enough supply being produced. Now, in certain markets, like in markets for imported goods, because we can't unload the ships fast enough, there'll be some supply shortages, and that'll create some inflation. And some markets where they need products like computer chips, you know, they're in short supply, so that's going to have some disruptions in the supply chain there. But overall, most of the inflation is not caused by disruptions in the supply chain. Well, the next question is, what is causing all that inflation? And I believe there are four reasons for that. I think I talked about this last time I was on the show. One, the Biden administration wants to wean the country off of fossil fuels. So they've taken action to restrict the supply. They've canceled the Keystone Pipeline. You can't drill on federal lands anymore. You can't drill in the Anwar off the coast of Alaska. They put in regulations to slow down the permitting process. So all of that restriction in supply at a time when demand is increasing has led to higher energy prices. So he asked me what would I would do. The first thing I would tell President Biden is to reverse all of those policies that you put into place last year. Allow the Keystone Pipeline to go forward. It'll take about 11, 12 months before that oil will flow through there, which means if he didn't stop it last January, it would have oil flowing through it today. So I've reversed that. I'd allow drilling back on federal lands. I'd allow drilling back on Anwar. And we're producing now about 1.5 million barrels per day, less oil than we did during the peak. So first thing I would do is reverse that. Secondly, we have a wage inflation problem. So wages have been going up, and you would say, well, that's good for the worker, except that it adds to the labor cost and drives up manufacturing costs for business, which tends to be inflationary. So I would take action to try to lure more Americans back into the workforce. Thirdly, the federal government has deficit spent nearly $6 trillion in the last two fiscal years. On a $22, $23 trillion annual economy, that's pure inflation. So I would say to the president, reduce government spending, and that will tend to bring inflation down. Now, he's not going to do that. The president wants to, in fact, increase government spending. And fourthly, I would say to the Federal Reserve, to end their what I call shockingly irresponsible monetary policy at a time when the economy was growing and we have an inflation problem. They kept increasing the money supply and keeping interest rates near zero. That fed inflation. Now, just recently, last month, they ended their bond buying program and they started to nudge interest rates up slowly. I think they're going to have to get a little more aggressive with that. Because the interest rates are so low, it's causing inflation in particularly interest rate sensitive products like cars and houses. In other words, someone said, hey, you know, I wasn't looking to buy a new house last year, but you know what? I can get a 2.5% mortgage, and the federal government handed me $11,000 in free money in the last 2 years, which is what the average family of four received. So someone says, hey, the government gave me the down payment money. I can get a 2.5% mortgage. I wasn't going to buy a house, but now's the time to do it. So hundreds of thousands of people started looking for houses. That increase in demand led to the rapidly rising prices in houses. Same thing happens with cars, although they did have a supply issue because they didn't have chips. So to wrap it up, what I would tell the president to do is reverse the energy policy and start encouraging production of fossil fuels rather than discouraging it. I would encourage more people to go back to work. I would reduce government spending. I would encourage the Federal Reserve to end their expansionary monetary policy more quickly.
Professor, I'll have you as president much faster than I'll have the guy in there now. I don't know who his handlers are, but they have to get out of Dodge because, first of all, for 8 months or 9 months now, we've been urging our elected officials to cancel the Biden executive order so that we could get the energy prices down, the 40% that they went up in the last year or a little over a year. I've been pleading people. I've been asking some of our great politicians, and I'd like to name them, who do nothing, who don't want to, oh, I don't want to offend the president and all by urging an Emergency Energy Act. Why not? Do these people realize? That's why I said they don't go out to do their own shopping or fill their tanks or any of that stuff. They're living in an alternate universe. As a result of that, you see what happened to our country over the years, not just now. Over the years, our poverty level went up. Our boys and girls are graduating from school without the skills and things that they need that would help them. A young guy told me, he said, if I could only have had those services offered to me in school, even if I didn't go out to be an electrician or a plumber, I'd know how to do something in my own home. Nothing was offered to me. It was just passing time. And you know, as a professor, how dangerous that is to allow a life to just pass by. But by opening the gas and oil from Alaska and all the offshore drilling, we'd go back to energy independence in maybe a month or two. And that would take all the costs, all the cost of everything going up, because taking a loaf of bread from the baker to the store it's going to be sold at, that takes gas. It takes extra time for the people to go and constantly go and do things to get the product to the stores where they're going to be sold. Nothing's taken into consideration. It's like living in a balloon, and we're just waiting for the balloon to burst. Larkin Conley, you know about the oil industry. Here's something I'm going to ask you and the professor to address. From what I'm told, that many of the industries in the United States that are doing the gas and oil, they said right now they're bringing in all this foreign stuff. So they don't have the pipelines and all for this energy to flow through. As a result of that, it's holding up the people in America. Jen Psaki said last week that they have 9,000 permits that they are allowing people to go and open the fields up again and all this rigmarole. And if they don't want to do it, then they can turn them in. Some of our regular producers in Texas and in the state of Pennsylvania said American workers have been downsized, put out of jobs in many cases totally, because we don't have the capacity to bring in all the foreign stuff to refine it and get it to the people in time. The pipes are only so thick. It's like going over a bridge and having to pay the toll. You wait in the line to get over to the toll taker. Well, if you don't have the space for the fuel to go through because they don't have enough pipelines open, then you have this problem and it has to be resolved. That executive order must be overturned. What do you think, Larkin Conley?
Well, good morning, Michael and Professor. Welcome back to the program. It's great to have you here. You are so profound in your statements, and I find myself to be on the same page that you're on. I will make one comment about the oil, this current situation in the oil industry. Of course, as you know, I worked for 27 or 28 years for a major oil, one of the Seven Sisters. In a management position. And what baffles me right now, the questions I have is that oil generally is priced on a world marketplace. And when oil gets up to $100, $120, $130 a barrel, where it is now, when it gets up really over $75 a barrel, every wildcatter in this country is out there. They're drilling holes in trees looking for oil because right. of the current price of a barrel. And that doesn't seem to be happening. And I think without being adversarial, everybody loves when gasoline is high priced, everybody loves to turn around and blame a segment of our economy that works on a fungible product, and they just don't get it. But at the same time, somebody has got to ask a handful, and the professor, I'm hoping that you agree with me. There's no reason we aren't out there on the federal land where we do have our leases. The pipeline obviously would bring down a product from Canada. All of these things would make us oil independent. But I don't get it. I don't know why Exxon and Mobil, Texaco, Amoco, all of the remaining big companies aren't out there, you know, drilling in their own backyards, trying to find oil at $120 a barrel.
Now, Larkin, is that true that there is no possibility of that happening big time in America, or so much product is coming from overseas now?
Well, they're going to listen. Biden has created an atmosphere where it's him on one side of the room, and the oil companies on the other side of the room, and nobody's in the middle of the room talking about how do we get this country weaned off of fossil fuels. It has to happen. Anybody that doesn't recognize the need for that to happen has probably been asleep for the last 10 years. It has to happen. But you can't shut off the spigot and say to the 400 million internal combustion engines on the road, guess what? We're going to cut off the supply, so you have to go electric. And, oh, by the way, the cheapest electric car out there right now is somewhere between $38,000 and $40,000 for four wheels and a big battery. And the government, in its own inimitable fashion, if you want to get them involved and make it wrong, they can do that. They have managed. I still offer the challenge to anybody in the world that can tell me one program the federal government has got involved with that they handled properly, that they didn't screw up. You know, the oil companies are sitting back going, no, wait a minute. We're obviously going to transition from fossil fuels to electricity, to a battery-operated vehicle. And we've got 297,000 service stations across the country that offer multiple services, but also, you know, could become battery charging stations. But the government's going to go out and build 500,000 of them on their own. Battery charging stations? The government? Why didn't they build our, back in the 30s and 40s and especially in the 50s and 60s, why didn't they build all the service stations we needed? I mean, the government has no place here.
That's right.
And it's just, We're terribly, terribly confused. The root of the problem, and I wanted to talk to the professor about global warming, the world order and the change in the global superpower that's going on right now. But the problem is that government is acting the same way American corporations are acting. They have no, you know, when I first went to work for Gulf Oil years and years and years ago, back in the early 70s, we had five-year plans. Every year, we wrote a five-year plan, then we reviewed that five-year plan. We even had really smart, intelligent corporate people up the ladder in different departments that would say, I want a 10-year plan. What's going to happen in 10 years? And I remember so vividly a guy presenting credit cards. We didn't have credit cards. You paid cash. You paid $29.9 for a gallon of gasoline, and you paid cash. Then all of a sudden, some guy shows up at one of our planning meetings and says, where do you see credit cards? Where do you see what credit cards do to our industry? Everybody's scratching their head going, how the hell is this going to work? But the fact of the matter is, the government today is worried about what can I do for this November election. Not what can I do as a leader, as a statesman, to make sure that this country is on a path that is sustainable 10 years from now. Corporately, America is doing the same thing. What can I do to the shareholder because it's going to get my bonus, make my bonus that much bigger? to the government people, it'll get me reelected. And their heads are all screwed up. They're just looking in the wrong direction. They're facing in the wrong direction, as I like to say. So, Professor, I'm sorry for that, but I think it's very strange that the oil companies are not out there now drilling for oil with the current price of a barrel on the world market.
Okay. If I may address all that, so Larkin said a whole lot of things there. Let me go back to the beginning. That's fine. The federal government has given out over 40,000 leases to drill on land. About 32,000 of those are being utilized, and about 9,000 aren't. Now, he brings up a good point. These businesses are motivated by profit. If it costs you $60, $70 to get the oil out of the ground, as soon as the price goes up to $75, $80 or above, and now up to over $100, they should be drilling like crazy, because it's very profitable to do so. So why aren't they drilling? And here's the answer. When they give out the 40,000 leases, there's no guarantee that there's oil anywhere that you drill. So what do the oil companies do? They hire geologists, and they say to the geologists, go, do your thing out there and tell us what the probability of finding oil is. And they do it, and they give them a probability. So the oil companies say, well, I'm going to drill on the leases where I have the highest probability of finding oil. And that's the whole 30-some thousand. Now, the last 9,000 have won a relatively low probability of finding oil. So it is risky for them to drill there. Number two, the federal government just added a zillion regulations to the permitting process. So now the permits are more time-consuming, and they cost more to acquire in order to be able to drill. And thirdly, the Biden administration has convinced the banking industry not to lend money to the oil industry for drilling and expansion purposes, because Biden doesn't want them to expand. As Larkin mentioned, they're trying to wean over to fossil fuels. So as I said before, if the government allowed them to drill where there's a higher probability of oil, like on federal lands or in Anwar, and if they got rid of all those regulations that slow down the permitting process, and if they convince the banks that it's okay to lend to oil companies again, then oil companies would start drilling. The other thing Biden said in the campaign trail is he wants to end fossil fuels completely as soon as possible. Well, that says to oil companies, I better not invest a lot of money longer term, because he's going to do what he can to shut this down. So there are leases available. However, to get a permit there is expensive, and there's probably a low probability of oil there. They'd rather drill where there is a higher probability. And you're absolutely right. When oil gets to over $100 a barrel, oil companies say, boy, if I can start drilling and bring the oil out of the ground at $75, $80, that's a heck of a profit. I'm going to do that. But because of the Biden administration policies, they aren't doing that. Now, you say to yourself, with regard to this overall economic policies, you're supposed to set certain economic goals, like the goals are usually to have stable prices, that is low inflation, full employment, that is unemployment under 4%, and growth in the economy. And your policies, monetary and fiscal policies, should be geared toward those goals. The Biden administration, their goals with their policies are not economic goals, they're social goals, and they're worried about climate change. So they set their policy to try to cure some of those real or perceived social injustices, like it's injustice CEOs make more than everybody else. It's an injustice college students graduate with debt. It's injustice that some people might not be able to afford daycare. It's injustice some people can't afford health care. So to cure those real or perceived social injustices, they set their policies rather than trying to set their policies toward their economic policies toward reaching the economic goals. And as long as the Biden administration makes it difficult or impossible to increase the supply of energy, the supply is not going to increase. So Biden said, well, look, I recognize we have a supply issue, so I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll release 1 million barrels a day for the next 180 days from the strategic reserve, which is ends up being about half of what's in the reserve. So what will that do? Well, temporarily, it might bring gasoline prices down slightly because they're fluctuating so much. Most of us won't even notice that. And then when the 180 days are up, oil prices are going to head back up again. The real costly feature in what he's doing is the oil in the strategic reserve now, much of it was purchased by the Trump administration during the year 2020. And why is that significant? Because when the economy of the U.S. and the world essentially stopped, they shut everything down, they had oil tankers pulling up the ports and people wouldn't buy the oil and they wouldn't unload it. They said, hey, we don't, you know, nobody's driving their cars. We don't need the oil. Well, the oil company said, look, we need the ships back because we're still producing oil. So the price of oil fell, and for a while, the price of oil turned negative. There was a point in April of 2020 where they would pay you $37 a barrel to take the oil. So President Trump said, wow, what a good deal this is. I'm going to take all that you'll give me. So he filled up the strategic reserve with oil that not only didn't cost us anything, they paid us to take it. So now he's going to use all that oil, and he's eventually going to have to replace it with oil that costs $100 a barrel or more. That's an $18 billion cost that we really didn't have to have. And further, while it may bring the price of oil down, that is releasing 1 million barrels a day for 180 days, may bring the price of oil down in the short term, it will actually make the problem worse because the lower prices will encourage people to use more gas and oil, and that will create a further shortage and some further problems going down the road. The other points were about what government policymakers do, and they're really not concerned. They're supposed to be concerned, and I agree with Larkin, they're supposed to be concerned with the welfare of the country. Instead, they seem to be focused on, well, we have to run for re-election in November, so Biden said, well, here it is April. If I get the price of oil down, for gasoline down for the next 6 months, come election time, things won't look so bad. So there's an example of trying to set policy looking at short-term election rather than a longer-term goal and really what's right for the country.
Professor, that's why you are a professor. Unbelievable. That's wherever I hear you, you're unbelievable. But you know, something was said by Larkin, which I really like, and I am out to encourage our elected people to get rid of this presidential executive order and get us back to 100% energy independence. Larkin said there should have been a 5 or 10 year program, a plan, like he did when he was working in the service industry. Wouldn't that be sensible if the president said, I'm putting this executive order in and I'm asking all of our fuel suppliers, all of our energy suppliers, to give us a 5 and 10 year plan, not just all of a sudden slapping somebody, you know, with this idea, cut everything when we only have in the United States of America 1% of the cars able to be run on electricity. It doesn't make any kind of sense. It's destroying our country. The longer growing prices continue to plague America, every one of us is going to be hurt, and our children and our grandchildren and their grandchildren. Once prices go up, it's not easy to get them down.
Yeah, it's exactly right, too. And look, transitioning away from an internal combustion engine toward electric cars is a good thing, and it's something that we should strive for. You can't do it overnight. You know, we've been using internal combustion engines for, what, over 125 years with the infrastructure, gas stations and things we have for that. You just can't turn a switch and stop everything. it should really be more of a market-driven procedure rather than the government. So what does that mean? Once the market, consumers, you and me, determine that, you know, we really would rather have electric cars, then that'll increase the demand for electric cars, and eventually they'll start making more. The government wouldn't have to subsidize them. If people really wanted them, the government wouldn't have to subsidize them because there would be sufficient demand. So as the consumers would say, look, you know, you're right, we really should start to switch to electric cars, so we'll start to increase the demand for electric cars. We see the auto industry starting to produce more now. That will reduce the demand for internal combustion engine cars, which means they'll start making less of those eventually, too. And maybe over a 10-year period or 15-year period, we'll see this transition gradually occur without having any real shock to the economy. The problem with the Biden administration is they want to decide what's best for the American people rather than the American people deciding for themselves, and there's a conflict there. So when Biden proposes these policies, they end up doing more harm in the short term than in the long term. You know, the way our market system works, I think it's a very democratic process. Consumers can vote for the products they want. And how do you vote for it? You buy them and you cast what economists refer to as dollar votes. So if consumers really wanted something and there was a demand for it, they'd cast their votes for those products. They'd buy those products. The demand would increase. Business, motivated by profit, would see where the demand is and make the electric cars. And then consumers would say, well, we're spending less on internal combustion engine cars, and we're not going to vote for those cars, not going to buy those cars. The demand goes down, and they'll produce less. That's the way a market is supposed to operate, where the majority of consumers interacting with business can determine what products are made, and consumers can tell what they believe is best for them rather than having the government tell them what's best for them.
You're right. And you know, Professor, I have to say, this was brought up during the election. Joe Biden said exactly these points. In fact, there was a man, Jim Kerry, former Senator Kerry, who is pushing this in the Biden administration more than anybody. And I don't know who else in the president's circles are telling him that this could happen within the next year. We have 1%. Now, right now, 1% of the cars available to go electric and are electric. 99% of the cars still have to have the gas to go a mile. It doesn't make any kind of sense. Now, as I said before, I don't know who the president's surrounding himself with, but it's definitely not people who know what's going on in the day-to-day life of the American people. I'm going to ask Mark Andel to welcome our special guest. Mark.
Hello, Mike. Thanks, and welcome, Professor. Great to hear from you. Thank you, Larkin, for adding your advice. Professor, you've got your so point on. I would absolutely vote for you. You know, with Mike's question, I love your answers and the education you give us. You know, when you said, I was thinking today's show, too, hey, first you got to reverse all the executive orders because we know fossil fuel has to continue, and we know that oil has driven the world. You know, the Japanese and bomb Pearl Harbor, they're actually after oil, and, you know, that wasn't the root of the cause. Oil has always driven this economy. But when you say reverse, you know, make it easier for oil and mining people here, absolutely. The raise increase has absolutely affected us, me and business. Again, I own General Welding and Fabricating, two manufacturing plants, and the Made in America stores. And, you know, reducing spending on the government, and then you mentioned, you know, we got to increase the interest rates. And I agree with everything you've said. And the big thing we're missing right now, the disposable income is so low. I'm seeing it affecting my stores. I'm seeing it affect everybody. I just worked my club last night talking to a lot of businessmen. You know, it depends what you're into. The person that owned a liquor store during the pandemic did well. You know, that's the only one I really know. But, you know, right now the main problem I see is people don't want to work. I got Moog Industries, top 100 company in the world behind me right in my town. And people just don't want to work. And there's a cultural change. It affects any business can't grow without working. And you talked about find a want, fill a want, find a need, fill a need. And that was always the goal with the cars. And I love how you say vote with your dollar, because I use that a lot in my speeches. And, you know, people with Made in America products, I always said vote with your dollar. You, the consumer, have the most power. You know, I just wanted to touch on this. People just don't want to work. I hear they might give another $1,000 away, and it's like injecting an engine with the nitrous oxide. It only lasts for a little while, but I don't like them giving out any more money. But I just wanted your opinion on this work ethic, lack of work ethic. And people just don't have that want. I can't get one of my guys really to do overtime. People want more money, but they won't work a second job. But we can't get people to work right now. They just won't come in. It's just everybody's problem I talk to in business.
I'll tell you, Mark, I sympathize with what you're going through. This is also a government-induced problem. So why do I say that? So the economy today is producing at a level that's about 2% higher than before the pandemic. We're doing it with about 1.5 million fewer workers. And every small business person, maybe big business person, that I've talked with says the same thing. I can't get people to come back to work. Even if I raise wages, it's hard to get people to come back to work. So why does that occur? So I actually went out and started talking to people, and what I found was about half the people that 1.5 million that haven't come back to work yet, and these are not exact figures, but this is just what I feel, about half of them seem to be 55 or older, and they were really nervous about the COVID, so they're just nervous about going back to work. The other half was mostly younger, 25 and under. So, I mean, these are young people, and I'm a professor, so I can have access to them and talk to them. So I said to them, listen, you haven't gone back to work. Why haven't you gone back to work? And they tell me, you know, I was working. I got laid off. The state gave me unemployment compensation, and then they kept extending how long I could collect the unemployment compensation. And then the federal government added $600 a week on top of what the state was paying me. And I saw a study that said 2/3 of the unemployed people are making more money being unemployed than being when they were working.
True.
Well, the 600 ran out, and then what did they do? They tacked 300 onto it, and that lasted for a while. So these people I talked to say, you know, I was getting all this money. I didn't have to spend as much. I said, well, wait a minute, why didn't you have to spend as much? I said, well, I haven't paid my rent in 2 years, and there's a moratorium eviction, so I can't get kicked out. So I haven't paid my rent in 2 years, and look, I have some student loans to pay, but, you know, they just suspended payments on that, so I don't have any student loans to pay. And I think just yesterday they extended the moratorium till the end of August. So they said, look, I have very little expenses. The federal government keeps giving me all this money, plus the stimulus money they gave me. Most of that I ended up saving. And they said, look, you know, I kind of like this. The government gives me money. I don't have to work. I can just sit around and do whatever I want to do. And I have a fairly decent lifestyle. So in the beginning of the show today, I said the government has to encourage people to come back to work instead of discouraging them from going to work. And they're discouraging them by just giving them free money that they can support themselves and reducing their expenses. They don't have to pay their rent or their student loans. So young people I talked to said, look, I'm going to stretch this out as long as I possibly can. When the money runs out, I guess I'll have to go back to work.
Yeah. Your point on, Professor, and last week I want to tell you I've got about 50, 60 employees, so I held a meeting, and I never did this in 36 years, but I gave a $1 raise across the board, everybody at the meeting. But I said, I'm going to ask you to put down three ideas you have to make yourself, your department, or our company better, and I want them turned in, and that's all you need to do to get this dollar. And the thought with the dollars, you know, give them $40 more a week, $160 more a month, help with the situation we're in, because each family is using about $200 to $400 more a month than they would have a year ago, is from my little study in my company. But I did that. You know, it kind of confused them. I always said, if you can't convince them, confuse them. But, you know, But and it worked. That works. You know, it's interesting. But I wanted the three ideas. I just want to feel that they're part of this. And I really went through that. It's not, you know, the last 2 years has been tough. This is one of the toughest times I've ever had in business. But, yeah, it's just tough. You know, a lot of the people, like you just said, the younger people are confused. And like you said, they're happy, maybe even still living with their parents, whatever. They're okay.
Yeah.
You know, they don't have that want where they definitely want to go buy land or build a house or start a business. And that scares me in a way.
Yeah. I think what you did, Mark, was excellent. You recognized the difficulty your employees are having, and the relationship between the employer and the employee is very important going forward, very important all the time. And when you showed that you understand the what's happening to them and you want to work with them, and all you're really asking is, hey, give me some ideas, give me some feedback so we can make this better for everybody. So I think that was a really an excellent thing to do. And you're going to end up building a lot of employee loyalty by doing that, which ends up helping you going forward. Now, it's relatively costly for you. You have 50, 60 employees. You just added $1 an hour to
$14,000 a year.
You know, good thing, add that up. It's a lot of money.
In tough times, mm-hmm. Professor. You know, I mean, so it was gutsy. My
Absolutely.
Whole team wasn't with me on that. my financial
you
team.
That as a good investment going forward, even though it was a difficult time for you to make that investment. I think that investment is going to pay off for you going into the future numerous times. And, you know, as an entrepreneur who has to live with risk all the time, you took a very risky position there. It could have backfired on you, but you took a very risky position because you understand that you need a good relationship between the employer and the employee, and you wanted to encourage people to work a little harder. Say, look, I'm giving everybody a raise. I don't know if you said this directly, but at least hoping everybody contributes a little bit more, and maybe that'll make the company better going forward.
Well said. Whoa. You know, Professor, as we're talking over the weeks and years, there's one thing that's been missing in this country, and that is people go on these campaigns, they talk, they put in their 30-second or one-minute ads, but they never really document what they would do if elected to that office. And that's exactly what happened in this past administration. They talked and they talked, but nothing was ever documented. A lot of the things that they said they were going to do, they have been pushing to do them, and some have been done. But I really think in the future, this is a time to get people to document what they would do and then give the voters a real choice, a real choice. And yeah. That's exactly what our guest from last week is doing. He's talking about what he would do if elected to Congress. The other people are just saying, well, I'll do what I can. You know, every day's a new day. No. You must say what you would do. My big thing is I want to see poverty in this country not continue to rise, because I'm in human services. I want to see it go down. I want to see people have a good feeling about themselves, that they have things to offer. They have places to be. They have to. They know some skills. They want to do that. But this seems to be a void in this country, and it's caused by the national leadership. How about we open the microphone for Rich Logis? Rich, how are you doing? And welcome our great guest, Professor Michael Bussler.
Hi, everyone. Good morning. Michael, Professor, thanks so much for coming back on. And, you know, you were just talking a few minutes ago about money comes into our bank account, get to stay home, save some money. Life's good, right? I have a word for that. It's a word that our panel has become accustomed to. And the more you come on our show, the more you're going to become accustomed to hearing me say it. And that word is called utopia. And what is, and to paraphrase Michael Corleone from The Godfather Part II, if history has taught us anything, it says that the conclusion, the denouement of utopia, is always mass suffering. And unfortunately, Professor, at the risk of trying to be the Debbie Downer here, I appreciate that when Michael asked you, do you have any solutions, you offered solutions. And if someone disagrees with your solution, that's fine. But no one can say you didn't offer a solution. And I sit here in front of everyone listening, and I'm sitting here, Michael, saying, I don't know if right now there is a solution until that utopian chasm finally occurs. And if to answer Michael Blihosh, the question you asked initially, Michael, what would I do if elected? And perhaps this is a little bit of idealism on my part. My first act, Michael, would not be a policy. The first act that I would ask rhetorically of the American people is this. Are you an American who likes to be lied to? Yes or no? And almost everybody that you ask, of almost everyone of whom that, and maybe I shouldn't say almost everyone, Professor. I'm not really sure how many. Maybe it's a lot. Maybe it's a majority. But nonetheless, it's still some significant swath of our population. Everybody will tell you, of course not. I don't want to be lied to, but of course they're lying to us when they say that. So if you want to be somebody who wants to be lied to, I can lie to you all day long. But if you're someone who doesn't want to be lied to, then we start to discover that all of these important issues are a lot more complex. And while I'm not saying this about anyone on this panel, America, the fact that we are such a politically traumatized nation says to me that it is increasingly and progressively becoming harder and harder to understand that all of these real-world, real-life issues, especially economic issues, if we're just traumatized people, we'll never be able to see beyond what it is that we want to hear. So that would be my first act, Michael. There's no policy in there. My first act is to ask a rhetorical question. Are you someone who wants to be lied to? And then at that point, the ones who don't want to be lied to, Michael, they will start to show themselves. Because what we learn about truth is that truth, irrespective of how long it takes to be exposed, Larkin, truth will always show itself. And so this is not a comment, Professor, at you or Larkin or Mark, or Michael or Henry or anyone listening. I'm just, my question in politics is not anymore red, blue, red, Republican, Democrat. They're all in the same business, Professor. Politicians are all in the same business. Retain power, and expand when opportune, and collect revenue in all of its forms. That's the business that every politician is in. Nancy Pelosi is in the same business that Ron DeSantis and Greg Abbott and Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz are in. I know that people on both sides don't want to hear that, but if you don't want to hear that, then you might be someone who wants to be lied to. So that's the first act, Michael, that I would set upon. And then we'll see what happens from there.
It may wise a lot of people up. Because right now, I'll tell you, 9 months ago, we were already talking about this Emergency Energy Act, getting Biden to cancel this executive order to put us back to where we were 16 months ago when the former president was in and presidents before him. We were never in this kind of an idiotic condition. 10-year plan. Larkin, you were absolutely right. They should present a 5-year plan, or if they're trying to go for an office for 4 years, a senator or 6 years, you have to put a plan. What are you going to do? Not just dwell in that office, not just raise your hand present or whatever. No, what are you planning to do for your constituents? I was pleased to hear that representatives in Pennsylvania are considering an act to move more production of energy in Pennsylvania, since we are one of the larger states in the United States that produce energy, to get that out so that the prices don't continue to go higher and higher, but mainly to put Pennsylvanians back to work. Whoa. some people in Harrisburg had some genius ideas. Let's see how far it's going to go. I know that there is a bill on the table. I want to see what's going to happen with it. And then we'll be able to talk about it's an election year for all of the House and part of the Senate. So I'd like to see what's going to be the story. We can't continue to kill people. Professor, the next time you come on, and I hope that you will join us again, I want to ask you, what can we do in America to reduce poverty? Half of the people living in poverty right now are working age and able-bodied people that could be trained for jobs. If those jobs were here in the United States of America, that is why our broadcast for some years has been promoting restoring jobs in this country, at least a 50-50 balance. I'd like to know, when people tell me, Michael, I'm not trained for anything, I'm not knowledgeable, I'm living in poverty, I have couple kids I'm taking care of, I have a disabled child, you know, it's all this. These people want to work. They want to do something. And yet no one in government, quite frankly, the old way of applying for welfare was better than the way it is today. Before, you had to prove that you were really needy. Today, they just want to give it to you to get rid of you. That's the bottom line.
Yeah.
I work in this system, so I know exactly what it is. They say, as soon as you call up, oh, you should apply for this, you should apply for that. Never asking, is there a possibility you have a resume to share or something like that that I can give to someone to maybe get? People call our agency looking for employees. They should have a place like they used to have the employment centers and all. None of that's there anymore. You're on your own. Government is not supposed to be the mother and father to the American people. Government is supposed to govern the best interest, freedom, and things like that. Never be there to be just giving stuff out and ruling, you know, like kings and dictators. It's not the way government, our Constitution is supposed to be there to be the best that you can as a free person. Government went overboard, taking in more ideas. Well, as you can hear by the music, we had a wonderful broadcast. Professor Michael Bussler, you are the best. And when they tell me you are the best, I really know it. And I probably will hear you again on Dawn, and I want to hear you back on our radio when you have another day to join us, because I want to see what we have suggestions about addressing the poverty situation here in the United States of America and getting more of those jobs back. The supply chain issues did open the eyes of many of the businesses, because some of them want the products off the ships, hurry up to sell. Many of them have products that are still on the ship. In fact, there's a ship stuck in the harbor and they can't move it because it was overloaded and it went onto the shallow part of the channel, and now they're having trouble to take off 20,000 containers. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I want to say thank you to Larkin Conley, Rich Logis, Mark Andel, Professor Michael Bussler, our engineer Henry Chaplinsky, and all of you. If you would like to support the Ukraine, you can go right on the front page of our site, PolishAmericanCenter.com, and click on Ways to Support the Ukraine. Thank you for all of your help. May God bless you, and may God bless America.
Have a great week, guys. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you. My pleasure. Look forward to doing it again.